This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Vito Russo, author of the book The Celluloid Closet, Homosexuality in the Movies. If you believed what you saw on screen, for close to 30 years you would have thought that there was no such thing as homosexuality. From 1934 to 61, the Hollywood Production Code forbade the portrayal of homosexual characters and prohibited any mention of homosexuality on screen. Russo thinks this lack of representation encouraged heterosexuals to ignore gays and left gays feeling that they were expected to remain invisible. On the other hand, he thinks the results weren't much better when the code was lifted. Then homosexuals were usually depicted as victims or villains, and their presence was inevitably used as an occasion for morality lessons. Russo has surveyed the portrayal of homosexuals from silent films to La Cage aux Folles, and he has interpreted the visual and verbal codes for homosexuality that Hollywood filmmakers developed when they were discouraged or prohibited from creating overtly gay and lesbian characters. Vito Russo explained to me why he thinks it's so devastating for lesbians and gays to see how they're portrayed in movies.
We go to the movies to see ourselves, to see a reflection of our lives. And in fact, motion pictures in this country have been a reflection of America, of the way we see our country and our people. And so when you go to the movies and you don't find yourself up there, it comes home to you in a double sense that you are an alien in your own culture. And I'm sure that that's not too far away from the way blacks have felt. I mean, for years, there were no black faces on the screen except in demeaning sort of minor roles. Even today, you don't see Asian faces on the screen. You know, what's it like for Asians who go to the movies and see Asian characters played by Caucasians sometimes? I mean, that, still today in the 1980s. And so I'm sure that it has tremendous psychological impact on other minority groups and for lesbians and gay men, perhaps even more so because the idea of homosexuals in society was so taboo. You know, you weren't supposed to exist. There were no such people.
Well, you say in your book that screenwriters and directors would talk to you, but you really couldn't find any actors who would talk about the subject.
That's right. Even heterosexual actors would talk about playing homosexual characters because they don't feel threatened. Gay actors, who very seldom play gay characters anyway, because just don't want to talk because it's too threatening to their own personal identity to have to get a little closer to the subject than they want to. They don't want to discuss it. You know, and I understand that. I also understand the reasons why gay actors are in the closet in Hollywood. I mean, it's very dangerous to come out of the closet in any profession, but even more so in Hollywood because Hollywood creates an illusion, a fantasy that people have to live up to.
I think it's fair to say that there are a lot of gays working in Hollywood. Why is it so dangerous for an actor or an actress to come out?
People don't like gays. I mean, it always comes back to this fundamental basic prejudice in terms of talking about gays. Gay people do not, in any industry and in any place in the country, do not come out of the closet because it is dangerous for them to do so, even today. I mean, a lot has changed in the last 20 years. You know, we've now been able to discuss a subject which 20 years ago you couldn't even talk about on radio or television. And yet it is still true that economically it's dangerous. Hollywood is a freelance town where every six or 8 weeks or 2 or 3 months or whatever it is, an actor is looking for a new job. So it's not like if you're a banker, what do you change jobs once in your life, twice? An actor changes jobs every 6 months. And if 10%, 15% of the people who do the hiring in that town don't like gays, you're cutting yourself out of that much of the job market. So it is true that a career can be destroyed by the revelation that an actor is gay.
Do you think that the AIDS epidemic is going to increase homophobia within Hollywood?
In the short run, yes. I think right now there's a lot of fear and panic. I think that so little is known about the disease that people are panicking, and we see that all the time. Should children be allowed to go to school if they have AIDS? Should actresses kiss an actor if he's known to be gay? All this sort of panic is set in. I think in the long run, no. I think in the long run it's going to change, and that the exposure that the issue of homosexuality has gotten through the tragedy of AIDS is eventually going to increase people's awareness of both the disease and the issue of gays. And that in the long run will help because knowledge is power. But right now there's a tremendous backlash. Tremendous. People are terrified in Hollywood right now.
Do you think that in the movies that there has been any more misinterpretation or less of lesbianism as opposed to male homosexuality? Oh, and has one been any more invisible than the other?
I think that there is a greater tolerance. This is deceptive. There is a greater tolerance for lesbianism in general because, first of all, it's more acceptable for women to be emotional with each other than it is for two men. I mean, two women holding hands coming out of a movie theater, it's okay. Two men holding hands, suddenly people freak out. And so in societal terms, it's more acceptable for two women to show affection to one another. This works in a very weird way, though. Lesbians have been portrayed on the screen essentially for the titillation of a male audience. Men, heterosexual men, have traditionally liked watching two women make love. It's a turn-on for them. And so, in a way, lesbianism has been used in the service of a male idea of what sex is. And two men turns them off. And so very often you'll get sequences in movies where two women are making love to serve a male audience. Like, a good example is, in 1980, Personal Best came out, which was about two female athletes who fell in love with one another. In the same year, Making Love came out, which is about two men who fall in love with one another. In Personal Best, the two women have a very powerful sexual scene where they make love, and it's shown on the screen. In Making Love, the two men barely kiss, and it was tremendously shocking. You could never have two naked men in bed together in a Hollywood movie.
Now, there was a period in the movies of close to 30 years where you couldn't portray homosexuality at all. The code lasted from 34 to 61. What specifically did it say on that subject?
Essentially, it was only one line. It said, sexual perversion or any inference of it is strictly forbidden. And so this was only one rule, which the Hays Code promoted, which included you could not show married people sleeping in a double bed. That's where we got single beds from. You could not show suicide. You could not show murder going unpunished. You could not use certain words. You could not show adultery, prostitution. I mean, it was a whole list of things you weren't allowed to do. And for that period of time, 30, 35 years, whatever it was, you couldn't even say the word homosexual on the screen or allow the public to know that such people existed because it was considered indelicate and against industry standards. The industry essentially was trying to protect itself from outside federal censorship because religious groups and civic groups all over the country were agitating in Congress for federal legislation of censorship against the movies. In other words, the government would control what you were allowed to see. So to stop that, the movie industry said, wait a minute, we don't want federal censorship. We'll do it ourselves. We'll draw up a list of rules and we'll stick to it, we promise. And so that's what happened. The movie industry essentially policed itself and made a list of rules and stuck to it.
What were some of the words that you weren't supposed to use?
You couldn't use pansy. You couldn't use homosexual, lesbian, fruit. I don't even think that faggot was a word that was used in the 1930s. But those are the ones that were listed, actually listed in a memo at RKO and several other studios.
Well, you write in your book that since you really couldn't refer overtly to homosexuality, that what ended up instead was that the symbols of homosexuality were manipulated. What do you mean by that?
Well, by the symbols of homosexuality, essentially, I mean the roles that were assigned to men and women. Masculinity and femininity are subjective, and yet they were manipulated to indicate sexual deviation without actually saying so. So that, for instance, in 1949, you had this movie, Young Man with a Horn, which was the life story of a jazz musician, Bix Beiderbecke, and it was Kirk Douglas, Doris Day, and Lauren Bacall. Lauren Bacall clearly played a lesbian in this movie. But it was 1949, and you couldn't say so. And so all the sort of iconography, the ways in which she was presented, were very masculine. She was tough, sophisticated, independent, all the things that eventually Katharine Hepburn obviously was playing for years, but she always lost in the end and submitted to her husband or her boyfriend. But all those qualities which we are supposed to take as masculine qualities, courageousness and drive and ability, were given to women who were considered less than women, you know, and their femininity was taken away from them. In the same way, the opposite side of the coin was that you got all these sort of stereotypical sissies. To make you laugh. In Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies, there was always the sort of effeminate butler or best friend. And it goes right through film history, right up to Victor Victoria with the incredible Robert Preston character, And Beverly Hills Cop with the Eddie Murphy's friend, I think it was a decorator or an art museum host, somebody who was, again, a flamboyant, effeminate sissy. And these signs, you know, of less than masculine became symbols for homosexuality. You didn't have to make it sexual. You were just saying this is a gay character because of the way he or she behaves.
So do you think that actually lesbianism and homosexuality became more stereotyped because in order to indicate mm-hmm. that there was a gay or a lesbian, you had to make the woman into a man or the man yeah. into a woman, so to speak, in yeah. order to give that message in a really covert way?
Yeah, well, because there was no allowance for depth or concept or context. And so, I mean, for instance, if you ask producers today on television, why is it that every time you have a gay character, the character has to be flamboyant and effeminate or stereotypical? And they say, well, that's what's called easy identification for television. If we have a gay character and we don't make that character a stereotype, how is the audience going to know that that character is gay? Well, the answer is that you have to take a little bit more time and you have to establish it in other ways. But we live in a very quick age where the audience has to be able to identify who they're looking at immediately. And in the absence of color or ethnicity, what they need is a quick stereotype to say, boom, gay character, and then go on to the next thing. So they don't have the luxury of establishing characters dramatically. You know, and making, you see, my idea is no more movies about homosexuality. My idea is that there should be movies, and in those movies, occasionally, some of the characters should be gay implicitly, and their homosexuality should have nothing to do with the story. They should just be there the way they are in life. Now, that's not done very often. I could think of one example in the David Bowie film, which was directed by Nicholas Rogue, The Man Who Fell to Earth. Incredible example, because Buck Henry in that film plays David Bowie's lawyer, and happens to be gay. He's incidentally gay. And it has nothing to do with the rest of the film. It's just established that he has a boyfriend. And at one point during the shooting of the film, Nicholas Rogue, the director, was asked by Buck Henry, why am I playing a gay character? Why is this character homosexual? And Rogue said, why not? There are homosexuals. And it was just sort of the easy solution to the problem. They exist in life. Why not put them in the movies? But don't make that the subject of every movie. It's like 10 years ago, if you had a black actor on television, you could bet that that character's color was going to have something to do with the story. That's why he was there. But now, there are black actors who play parts that could easily be played by a white actor. Now, that's changed. It has not so much changed with gays because they don't want to go into the issues of sexuality, and they're afraid of offending people. There are some people in this country who just think that this subject should not be broached. Still.
You speculated before about some of the reasons you thought some men are so uncomfortable by scenes of two men kissing or making love mm-hmm. on the screen. But the whole, kind of sissy type character makes people really uncomfortable too. Can you talk about that kind of characterization and why you think it's become a kind of, you know, code for a homosexual, and why that too seems really threatening to a lot of people?
It threatens our idea of what masculine is. We value masculinity in this country tremendously, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't. All I'm saying is that what we consider to be masculine is not necessarily the right definition of masculine. You know, to many people, masculine means anything that does not smack of womanhood. You know, we ascribe certain feelings to women and women only. And I think that when men put on a dress, like Milton Berle in a dress, it's funny. Anybody who goes in drag is funny. A guy in a dress is a very funny idea. It's used in Tootsie, La Cage aux Folles, constantly, even in Victor Victoria at the end. When Robert Preston dresses up as Julie Andrews, it's hilarious. We laugh at that because when a man puts on a dress, he's demoting himself and he's making a fool of himself. Women are not as highly valued as men in the culture. And I think that there's a sexist idea in there of any man who acts like a woman is making a fool of himself. However, the reverse is not true. It's real interesting to see that when women dress up as men, like you see Marlene Dietrich in a tuxedo or a top hat and tails, or Greta Garbo in Queen Christina dressed up as a man, it's fascinating to people. Men and women adore that kind of androgyny. It's attractive to them because women, when they put on men's clothes, seem to step up in class.
And get power,
exactly. Men are better than women. They have power. And, you know, they're supposed to aspire to power. And I think that's a good word. I mean, that's what I think it is. I think it's a matter of power, is that when a man puts on a dress, he loses whatever power he is given by his manhood, you know? And I think that we're hung up on that, frankly, you know, that it shouldn't be that way.
My guest is Vito Russo, who is the author of the book The Celluloid Closet, which is a study of how homosexuals have been depicted in movies throughout movie history. What about some of the Roman epics and biblical epics? And I ask that in part because you referred to a few scenes that were actually deleted.
There were scenes deleted from Spartacus. There was a scene between Laurence Olivier and Tony Curtis. And Tony Curtis was a slave, and Laurence Olivier was a Roman emperor. And Olivier was in love with Tony Curtis and seduces him in one scene where Tony Curtis is giving Laurence Olivier a bath. And they cut that because it just made everyone too nervous that this could be the motivation for anything. This happened quite a bit. And constantly, this was a little late. I mean, Spartacus was 62, 63, around there. But in the 40s and 50s, constantly scenes were being cut from films, which were in the original novels or the scripts, Broadway plays, which were brought to the screen, and then the homosexual scenes were cut. I mean, it's the most famous case is probably Lillian Hellman's The Children's Hour, which was made first in the 30s as a film called These Three. And instead of two teachers accused of being lesbians, they changed it to two women accused of being in love with and sleeping with the same man in a triangle. And that was daring enough for 1936. And it wasn't until the early 60s that they remade that film with Audrey Hepburn and Shirley MacLaine, and they restored the lesbian theme to it, because by the 60s, eventually you could do that. But this was constant, and it had the effect of removing homosexuals from the truth. You know, this is true of biographies, too. Every time we see a film based on the life of a famous living person who is homosexual, they change that person and make them heterosexual. I don't mean living today. I mean Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Cole Porter. And so the public has just been told a lie in order that they might be more comfortable. And the movies are there to do that. And movies are about illusion. They're not there to serve the truth. They're there to serve America's idea of itself. You know, it's like those comedies on television in the 50s, Leave It to Beaver and the Donna Reed Show and Make Room for Daddy. I used to think that my family was strange because we didn't all eat together at the same time in the morning like they did on television. That's the way the movies and television portray America, as in an ideal sense. This is the way we think we are, but we're never really that way.
When the code was lifted, and it was lifted in which year?
61.
Okay, so when the code was lifted and movie makers were allowed to have gay roles or use the word homosexual,
right.
Was there a big rush?
Yeah.
similar
to the one we had in 1980 with Making Love and Victor Victoria and all those films. We had the same thing in 1962. I mean, in 1962 alone, there was The Children's Hour with Hepburn and MacLaine. There was Advise and Consent, a film by Otto Preminger, in which Don Murray played a homosexual senator of the United States who commits suicide. There was Walk on the Wild Side, in which Barbara Stanwyck played a lesbian. And lots of films from England, Victim with Dirk Bogarde and A Taste of Honey and The L-Shaped Room, constantly films about this subject because, first of all, the code had just disappeared. Second of all, television was killing the movie industry. People were staying home in droves to watch TV, and they were trying to drag people into the movie theaters with what they called adult subject matter for the first time. And so you were getting a lot of films in which homosexuality was portrayed.
You have at the end of your book a list of ways that people who, that gay characters were either killed or committed suicide at the end of the movies. I mean,
true.
Have that many gay characters in the movies taken their own lives?
Yeah, the vast majority. It was the standard ending for a homosexual in the movies.
Did this start in around 1962?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it started at the turn of the century. I mean, one of the very first films ever to deal with homosexuality came out of Germany in 1919, and the gay person committed suicide at the end of that movie. And it's been that way ever since. I think it's part of the fact that movie makers were considering the audience. You have to make a moral judgment on these people. And also, it takes from life. I mean, you can't just ignore the truth and say, well, the movies distorted everything. The movies did not distort everything. There is a truth in every stereotype. And for many, many years, homosexuals killed themselves because society would not tolerate them. A person would discover that they were gay, and they would commit suicide. And I'm not saying that this happened in the thousands. There are obviously millions of happy, healthy gay people, you know, but this was a staple of American movies, that homosexual life ends in tragedy, something that we know is not true now. But for years, the gay person killed themselves at the end of the movie. It happened in 26 out of 28 major films in 20 years, which dealt with homosexual characters.
Can you name three of them?
Oh, sure. I could. Well, The Children's Hour. At the end of The Children's Hour, Shirley MacLaine hangs herself. At the end of Advising Consent, Don Murray slits his throat. At the end of Justine, Cliff Gorman gets killed by having a hat pin stuck through his neck. At the end of The Fox with Sandy Dennis and Anne Haywood, a tree falls on Sandy Dennis and kills her. Constant. I mean, even today, there's a film called Kiss of the Spider Woman, and it's a wonderful film. And in fact, the stereotype is used to heighten the dramatic quality of the character, and I think it's a terrific characterization by William Hurt. But he, in effect, commits suicide at the edge of that film by allowing himself to be killed by terrorists and the police. He gets caught in the crossfire on purpose. He sort of gives up his life for an ideal. And it's sort of, in a way, it's depressing because people say, oh, God, as good as these movies are, do we constantly have to put up with a homosexual who dies at the end of the movie? And you think to yourself, well, to some extent that's true. And to another extent, there is no movie without dramatic conflict. Nobody wants to make or see a movie about constantly happy people who have no conflict in their lives. Movies are made of conflict. So you have to balance it a little bit. All we're saying in terms of gays is there are as many different kinds of gay people in the world as there are different kinds of heterosexuals. And so what we want to show is the diversity of homosexuality and not simply use the same old tired stereotypes over and over again. But the industry's not like that.
Did you like Kiss of the Spider Woman?
Very much. Very much. I think it's a terrific film.
Let's look at some of the modern and, you know, fairly recent movies that have had gay characters in it. Why don't we start with The Boys in the Band, which is always referred to, and I know it's a film that a lot of people really hate because of many of the stereotyped homosexuals who are in it. What do you think of the characterizations in it?
Well, it's interesting. When I first saw it, I was very angry at it because I was in a period in my life when I was being a gay activist, and not that I'm not anymore, but I was in a very angry period, and I saw it as a regurgitation of all these stereotypes about gay people. And now I look at it again 15 years later, and you think to yourself, you know, the characterizations are really incredibly accurate. There are a lot of different kinds of gay people in that movie. And although it reflects the self-hatred of the 60s and the suicidal tendencies of the 60s and how awful and troubled gay life was in the 60s, it reflects the reality of that time. Gay life was very troubled in the 60s. And this is the way a lot of gay people felt in the 60s. And so in an evolutionary way, it's a very interesting film.
What about La Cage aux Folles?
The movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I loved La Cage aux Folles, the movie. I just thought it was sensational. What's interesting about La Cage aux Folles is that, first of all, it's the highest grossing foreign film ever to play in the United States. And that it appealed to everyone, gay and straight, because although these were two very stereotypical gay characters, there was a humanity about them that made you like them. They were not cardboard characters. They were people who you cared about. And it was interesting to sit in the audience and watch that film, and you would listen to the gays laughing at different lines than the other people because what struck them funny did not strike everyone else funny.
Can you think of an example?
There was a scene in the very beginning of the film where Alban, who's the drag queen, is in a temper tantrum and won't go on stage, and he claims that he's sick, and the doctor comes, and the doctor is telling him to calm down, and there are thousands of people out there waiting to see you, and you can't disappoint them, and I want you to take this pill, and I want you to go out on stage and perform. And suddenly Alban looks up and he says to the doctor, "Did I take you away from your dinner?" And he says, "Well, yes, but it'll keep." And he said, "What is it?" And he says, well, it's a chicken with a white sauce. And he said, oh, all right, here's what you do. You heat it very slowly over boiling water. And this is exactly the kind of a thing that a gay audience would roar over, because here's this drag queen in the middle of a tragedy, screaming and crying, and he finds out that the doctor needs to heat the white sauce, so he goes, changes gears completely and starts telling him how to cook the sauce. And it's just so typical of a certain kind of old-fashioned gay man that it was funny. But a straight audience wouldn't necessarily know that. I mean, there were a lot of ghetto humor in that film, you know.
I think some gay people didn't like the movie and thought, well, sure, the movie's popular because it's like what you were saying before, yeah, that, you know, straight people love to come and laugh at men wearing dresses, mm-hmm, and acting with female mannerisms.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I don't separate films like that. You see, I feel like I can enjoy a film if it's good, even if I find things about it that are offensive. I mean, while recognizing that the easiest thing in the world is to portray an effeminate, funny gay character. Comic gay characters get more laughs than anybody else. At the same time, there are some good ones. Look at Victor Victoria. I thought it was a riot. You know, and I know why they're laughing at it. The audience is not threatened by an effeminate gay man. Try to put a serious gay person on the screen and they get very scared.
Do you think it's a good idea to insist on positive role models? And I ask that, it seems, mm-hmm, like, oh, of course it would be. But on the other hand, the movies that I love most tend, yeah, to be about very dark themes.
Yeah.
And I mean, where the people who, at the center of the movie, are not the most admirable people, but it's a really gripping, chilling movie.
Really? Who's a positive role model in heterosexual films? I mean, not many. A few comic characters, you know, like kids might look up to certain characters that they find funny in the movies, like, you know, Saturday Night Live characters or something. But the truth is that movies are made of, like, as you say, dark forces at work, that conflict in people's life is what stories are about, and that just to ask blindly for some hero character is ridiculous, you know. I mean, the only gay characters who have worked as role models on the screen, good or bad, have been gay characters taken from life, like Dog Day Afternoon. There was a great TV movie called A Question of Love with Jenna Rollins and Jane Alexander about a lesbian mother in Texas who was fighting for custody of her son. Based on court transcripts, brilliant film, almost the best work that's ever been done on the subject on television, because it was true. And so in those cases, I would say, sure, here's a battling lesbian mother who's willing to fight for her kids. That's a role model. But don't create some sugar-coated character who's gay and is some hero just so that people have somebody to look up to. That's not good movie making.
My guest has been Vito Russo, author of the book The Celluloid Closet, Homosexuality in the Movies. It's published in paperback by Harper & Row. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Ron Barron and Jay Goldman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.